This interview is with Doris Eastman, 123 4th Street South, Moorhead, Minnesota. She was involved in the communications field in Moorhead and Fargo from 1934 until 1979. This interview is being held at Moorhead State University Recording Studio on April 10, 1985. The interviewer is Janet Gallagher, Audubon, Minnesota, representing the Communications Committee of the Oral History Project, sponsored by the Heritage Education Commission. In preparation, a list of questions were suggested. At the end of the interview, we hope to have touched on them to some extent. To begin with, Doris, where were you born?
I was born in Alexander, North Dakota in 1916. My dad, Henry Winnie, was working on the newspaper there. But when I was 4 or 5 years old, we moved to Williston, North Dakota, where he took a job at the Farmer's Press. It was there that, you might say, my future was settled, because to the Farmer's Press's editor came Wayne Peterson, and inevitably he came to our house, and he soon wooed and married my sister Helen. They celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary in 1971.
Where did you get started in your communications area?
Well, until I was in the sixth grade, I went to school in Williston. But after that, I bounced from one small North Dakota town to another, as my dad, who had restless feet, changed jobs, but it was always on a newspaper. When I was 12, I went to school in Rolla, North Dakota, where I stayed with Wayne and Helen. Wayne had bought the Turtle Mountain Star. Then in my junior year, I was at Fargo Central, and I took a commercial course, typing, shorthand, bookkeeping, in addition to the required subjects such as English and social studies. I planned to be somebody's indispensable job secretary, but came 1934 in graduation, and I didn't have a sign of a job. Then Wayne Peterson came. He had in 1930 started to work as editor and part owner of the Moorhead Daily News, with option to buy out the other owners, the Lums of Wahpeton, North Dakota, which he did about 1936. Wayne said he had this job of a society editor open, and he thought it would be a good idea if I took it. I didn't think much of the idea because I was shy, and that job meant meeting and talking with all sorts of people, but there was no other job in sight, and I was used to taking Wayne's advice and orders, so I became society editor of the Daily News. That bit of nepotism wouldn't work these days, I think, because a person would need college credits to be eligible, even as a relative. It seems funny, though, because the girl who took my place when I left in 1939 had a college degree, but she was scared stiff of talking on the telephone, which was one of her principal jobs. Incidentally, when I began the job, my brother-in-law, Wayne, or Pete as we called him in the family, became my boss, and I called him Mr. Peterson.
That was the beginning. How about the other dates in your career?
That first stint at the Daily News lasted until 1939, when I became a housewife and later the mother of three sons. Ed Eastman had come to the Daily News in 1936. While he was attending MSTC, he was college correspondent for the Daily News and worked during the summer. He had written for a number of publications at MS, and at one time he told me he and Byron Murray, a longtime instructor at MS, had talked about buying a small town newspaper. He was elected to the College Hall of Fame in 1935 when he was editor of the Precepter, the name of the annual at that time. It later became the Dragon. When he graduated, he was offered teaching positions, none of which paid more than $60 a month, and most of them required teaching four subjects, and most of those included music. He had studied violin and piano when he was a child, but he had no interest in teaching music. So he got a job out at Armour's packing plant in West Fargo in the bookkeeping department. When Dick Hackenberg, who was sports and telegraph editor at the Daily News, accepted a good offer in another city, Wayne went out to Armour's and hired Ed. Some years later, he was named city editor. It was that job he held when Wayne sold the Daily News in 1945. He worked for the new owners until 1948, when we made the mistake of buying a small paper in Sheldon, Iowa. Wayne had become a newspaper broker after he sold the Daily News, and he almost had the Holly Herald for us. And of course, Holly was our native stamping grounds for Ed and his family. But at the last minute, the owner backed out. It seems as though when you start that process, it isn't as easy to shut it off, and Wayne looked for another paper. The Sheldon Sun was one of two papers in a town of 7,000, and it was the newest one. And we just weren't ready for the variety of things that came up. Ed was good at writing and editing, but he didn't do too well with the advertising. I was terrible at selling classified ads, which was my job. And we paid a woman a good salary as society editor, a job I could have done handily. Robert McGregor Moorhead had come in with us in the printing mechanical part. We didn't do all that great with the job printing either. Incidentally, later the Sun and the other paper merged. In 1950, the Moorhead Daily News Society job was up for grabs. They didn't like what the young woman was doing. Actually, she was ahead of her time. She went out for features and used a lot of wire copy. But the editors wanted names, names, names. So I applied for the job and started shortly thereafter. A few months later, Ed was hired to work on the night editorial desk of the Forum. In 1951, Ruth Fairbanks, woman's editor at the Forum, she'd been there about 20 years, asked if I would like the job as her assistant. I remember at the time I thought, yeah, staying in the same job for 20 years. I figured that it would probably be a good deal because Ed was over at the Forum. Although I knew I was going to miss the Daily News, where I more or less had my own way. But I took the job and remained there until my retirement in 1979 at age 63, and Ed had retired the year before at age 65. By the time I retired, I had been woman's editor for 20 years.
What were the working conditions, Doris, when you started your job?
As far as salary, in 1934, when I was hired, I was given the offer of $10 a week, and I took it, of course. For this, I sat at the telephone 2 or 3 hours a day asking people if they had any news. And these items were used to fill two columns under the heading Social and Personal. It also included meetings, lists of visitors at hotels, patients in hospitals, people who came to town to get car licenses. It was a decidedly varied column. I also waited on the counter when everyone else was busy. As I recall, there were three of us on the editorial staff most of the time. Dick Hackenberg, sports and telegraph editor, Stan Cowan, the city beat, and me. Others came and went. One of them was Lloyd Sveen, who had done some work for the Daily News during his years at Concordia. Again, Wayne remembered his work and hired him just as he had done with Ed. Later, of course, Lloyd went to the Forum, as did Stan and Ed and I. In fact, Wayne used to complain that every time he got somebody trained the way he wanted them to work, the Forum came along and hired them. Of course, the Forum paid better wages and benefits than the struggling Daily News did, which under Wayne was finally making a decent income. As for the physical aspects of the job, we worked in a small, dusty, hot in the summer and drafty in the winter editorial room. Back of a wood wall was the press, which started about 3:30 in the afternoon. The rumble of that press made conversation a little difficult. It also complicated another job I had. I had become a secretary, as originally planned, but it was secondary to my society editor's job, and was done usually about the time the press went to work. Since Mr. Peterson's desk was right next to the wood wall, with the press on the other side, you can imagine I had some difficulty hearing him. He was a native of Arkansas, and he had a soft voice, and the combination of voice, press noises, and inexperience with shorthand brought me close to tears at times. But I managed it by typing a rough copy of the letters and having Wayne check them before I sent them out. Later, Mr. Peterson bought an old dictaphone. I was not great, but at least I could turn the recording device back any time and check on what I was doing, rather than asking Mr. Peterson to repeat. It was especially dusty, noisy, and hot the year 1935, when the Center Avenue Bridge was being built. We were right there, practically sitting on the bridge, and every time the pile driver plunged down, the building shook. And that pile driver went down hundreds of times a day. We thought the building might get rattled to pieces, and I had a feeling that was what Mr. Peterson was hoping. Then he could get damages and build a new building. That didn't happen, but in 1936 he had an addition built, which gave us a much better office space. At that time, too, they dug a basement, and in 1939 they put in a new press. But of course, by that time, Ed and I had decided I should quit my job and become a full-time housewife. So the fact the press was far away from the office didn't make much difference to me. In 1950, when I started back at the Daily News for the second time, some of the ideas had changed, but not all that much. And that brings me to a question: the changes in the way the news was regarded. One of the questions was how things had changed. Earlier I said that my principal job was to fill columns with social and personal notes. The big thing was to get as many names into the paper as possible. We used all the hostesses and the people on the programs in our items. We carried everyone and the least connected with weddings. One of my jobs was to edit country correspondence. Those were filled with the same names week upon week, and you didn't take any of them out. So I got to know by name practically everybody in Clay County. Of course, there were some who said, "No, I do not want my name in the paper again this week." But mostly, they came week after week. Small towns still have their correspondents, but they're a little more sophisticated and aren't allowed to have items like somebody going across the road for coffee. When I first went to the Forum, I again sat and called ad nauseum there were lists of students who would be going out of town for college, and there would be lists of those same students coming home for Christmas, and of their guests, male or female, that they brought back with them. We had guest lists for the big holiday parties. One of the last times I used a lot of the lists, a lot of names in the stories, was when I decided to cooperate with one of the women's golf groups. They wanted to organize a pairings setup, and they needed to have that in every week. Well, it was fine. It started with maybe 20 names, and I let that run for about 3 years. I shouldn't have, but I did. And it was into several hundred names by the time I got through, because the first one, when the other clubs found out how successful it was, they wanted in. And so I was running three or four pairings lists from these different things. I finally told them they'd have to find another way to do it. We were using too much space on names. But I believe, if we hadn't publicized it in the first place, that the woman's golf wouldn't have gotten as far as it was, as it did go. In those days, there were very few items about women's sports in the sports pages. When I was at the Daily News, I had to contact people up and down Center Avenue and the main side streets, because I went out every afternoon to make rounds and pick up items for the social and personal column. I usually managed to end up at Briggs Floral, which was on Center Avenue and 8th Street. It's the American Square building now, but it was a nice little place then. And they always had items. Mr. and Mrs. Briggs did get around. And also there were goodies in the coffee pot. You wouldn't think there'd be hazards about those little items, but I remember several times when I got caught on somebody, caught with somebody feeding me false information. I was 18 and gullible, and unsuspecting that someone would try to fool me. I remember when a very good friend of Wayne Peterson's, who worked in a clothing store, gave me an item about a Mr. Hart Schaffner and Marks coming to visit. I had no idea that Hart probably was long gone, and of course I trusted my source. Another was an item I received periodically about a young man who went to visit his folks in a small North Dakota town. And I printed it periodically, and it wasn't until quite some time that I learned that the young man went to this North Dakota town because he had a hangover and he needed to rest up, and he had to get some money from his folks. It's interesting that nobody challenged either one of those two items. So apparently not too many people knew that Hart was long gone or whatever. And we apparently didn't have too many readers in North Dakota. On the other hand, I had a very indignant woman come into the office and ask me to please stop putting her name in the paper. The thing she was unhappy about was that her name kept appearing in old Moorhead column. I was responsible for that, and I spent hours up in an old, hot, dusty balcony above the press going through old copies so we would have items from the 1800s and the early 1900s. She'd been very active in those days, and her comings and goings had been recorded very well. But she was getting to an age where she didn't especially want to be reminded, I guess, of how active she was back in those days. I really missed her. In my innocence, I didn't think of the potential embarrassment of these, my going to the hotels and taking down the names of those who had registered. And apparently the clerks didn't think too much of it either, because they always gave it to me. And so either there wasn't any hanky-panky going on, or the folks didn't sign their names or something, because I never had any repercussions on that either. It was at Briggs Floral, which was across from the Comstock Hotel, that I first met Morris Fredericks and Marge and Norm Overby and Marty Holson, all of whom went into the floral business for them on their own some years later.
Were there some of the, what were some of the events that affected you in your job?
Well, as woman's editor, I really didn't cover big events at the Daily News in those early days. I was strictly who went where, when, and so on. I do remember finding a word in one of the club announcements that I didn't recognize. I called the woman who was to give the program and asked her what it was, and she invited me to come up and look at her talk. And so I carried a story about it the next day, or a couple days after she spoke. And the day after the story appeared, A.J. O'Loughlin, the chief of police, clumped in and threw a bunch of weeds on my desk and said, "There's your marijuana. Grows all over the county." Police station was right next to the Daily News, and the chief strolled in fairly often, but he wasn't happy with me on that morning. I have tried and tried to find that story in the Daily News, and I cannot find it, but I well remember the day that O'Loughlin was unhappy with me, because the word was marijuana, and it came to be mean quite a bit in the days in the future. Let's see. On my return trek to the Daily News in 1950, my big responsibility was to do this special session that would mark the opening of the Frederick Martin Hotel. It was on the corner of Center Avenue and 4th Street, it is now known as the MF building, Midland Federal, I think it is. It has this big sign on it. Nobody seemed to think or remember that the name of the hotel was Frederick Martin. They always talk about the Fargo Moorhead or FM or whatever. And, of course, logically, if it had been Fargo Moorhead, it would have been Moorhead Fargo, as it is now, MF. But the Martin Johnson, a realtor, was one of the big investors of the hotel. And, as I say, he named it after his baby son. By that time, some more new owners had taken over the Daily News. After Wayne left, ownership changed several times. And I was one of the oldsters in terms of living and working in Moorhead. Whatever the reason, I was given the responsibility of this special edition, which scared me stiff. But it was kind of a challenge and a compliment, too. One thing it did was give me a chance to know a man by the name of Mr. Brown. We called him Brownie. He was the first manager of the hotel, and he had big ideas. Here I was with my depression-oriented attitudes, and here was Brownie, who didn't seem to care what he spent, just so it paid for the best. We spent hours going over the stories I wrote. It had to be all done in the evening when he got through with his work at the hotel, and I got through with my work at the office, and it was quite an experience. Of course, the hotel language was foreign to me, and I needed the editing to be sure I wasn't goofing up. some of the employees got a little over-enthusiastic in the description of their duties, and Brownie sputtered and used the black pencil. At the big opening party where there were orchids galore, Ed and I sat with Nanny and Fanny Marquette. The Marquettes were famous in the FM area, Manny with his sports broadcasts on radio and Fanny because they had a breakfast chat radio program together. I still have the picture. Another big event in my life came during the early days. Wayne Peterson, who was a great promoter for community activities, had decided that Moorhead should have a country club. And that was in the early 1930s, and there sure didn't seem to be a chance that they could get one. But Wayne checked up, and he found that WPA was looking for places to put their workers. So he went out to Oakport Township and made an arrangement whereby Oakport would apply for this building, and then as a township hall, and then lease it to the Moorhead Country Club Corporation. I think it was like for $1 a year. And then they could have their township meetings in there periodically. It turned out to be a beautiful building. The WPA workers were taught to cut stone, and the building is mostly stone. Came the time that the opening party was being planned, and Wayne, of course, was taking it for granted I was going to the party. After all, I would probably have to write about it. But I said, how can I go to a party like that? I can't afford a formal. And I knew that everybody was planning on all these beautiful formals and so on. And I wasn't about to spend any of my hard-earned money on a dress I probably wouldn't wear more than a few times. So my boss said, go down to Waterman's, which was the big department store in Moorhead, and buy a dress and charge it to me. I don't remember whether he gave me a limit, but of course I was naturally conservative, so I chose a dress that I could cut off and wear as a summer dress for several years after. I never knew whether that dress was paid for by my brother-in-law, Wayne, or by my boss, Mr. Peterson. He probably took it off as a business expense. The tornado of 1957, was, of course, one of the biggest stories, and the Forum received a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage. Ed's picture and that of Ruth Fairbanks are among the ones that are displayed as having been a big part in putting out the edition. But I was, Ed was still on the night side, and so he was at the office, and Ruth lived about 4 blocks from the Forum, and of course she scooted over immediately after getting word of the tornado. And when I called in, I was told to stay home and be prepared to do some follow-up the next day. One of the stories I did was thousands and thousands of pieces of clothing that people brought in to this big, you could call it supply depot or something. And then it flowed out when people came because some of them had lost just everything. I didn't get to see the tornado area until a couple of days after the tornado hit. I do remember I went with some other volunteers out onto the Moorhead Country Club golf course and picked up debris from across the river. Another event that changed things was the newsprint shortage in 1975. That gave us 6 months of trying to decide what we would eliminate from our regular coverage. It set the pattern for coverage of many items that we had listed in detail before, paper became plentiful again. We kept some of our policies of cutting down on details, and gradually we developed more and more features. Before women started to get into politics in larger numbers, the women's desk at the forum covered their activities. But we covered them so completely, it was decided that they were getting a little bit too much, and so they were put in with the rest of the politicians in the city, and the state desks handled the stories. The same thing happened to stories about wives of political figures. Inevitably, when the big man brought his wife along, the women's desk was assigned to interviewer. I tried, of course, to get as much background on the women as I could before it came to time to interview them. Mrs. Nixon was easy. I covered her 3 times, and she was gracious and talked about her family and life in the White House and rigors of the campaign, but she wouldn't discuss politics. Her quote was, "That's Dick's field." The first Mrs. Rockefeller was much like that, although she did get a little political once in a while. But Mrs. Romney absolutely refused to talk about recipes and decorating her home. She told what the children were doing then, because they were campaigning along with the rest of the family. But she wanted to talk about some of the opinions on the changes her husband wanted to make and if he were elected president, and some of her own interests outside the home. I had no difficulty with the Nixon interviews because they were arranged. We went to a hotel room and we sat with her, and she answered the questions, and there was no problem. There would probably be 3 or 4 women from the from newspapers and from the TV stations and radio stations. But she was very gracious and spent as much time as we asked. But when it came to both Mrs. Romney and Mrs. Rockefeller, I just about didn't get interviews, because they were supposed to be fit into all these activities. So what I did was follow each one of them around most of the day, and finally, I guess they took pity on me or something, because they invited me to go with them to the airport in the car, their cars alone, and so I got the quotes I needed. Mrs. Rockefeller was such a sweet person. And I really was unhappy when they were divorced. I remember listening to Mr. Romney and at the luncheon, and I watched his wife, and she was sitting there listening as if that's the first time she'd ever heard him talk. Well, of course, I'm sure she had heard that talk 100 times. But you certainly would never know it by looking at her. I also remember I sat next to Roger Mudd at that Romney luncheon, and he wolfed down his food. I suppose he picked up that habit because he never knew when he was going to have to get up or down. But that's what I remember about Roger Mudd, was that he ate. He really pushed it in. One of the duties I took over shortly after going to the forum was that of club notes. The established practice was to call the publicity people to see if the program was to be as it was printed in the book. That took a lot of time, but it was the way that it had been done. Finally, I put a note at the top of the column saying if a change hadn't been called in by such and such a time, the program was going to be printed as it was in the book. it freed me for other duties, and one of the things was that I started to do a lead for that column. It gave me some practice for when I became women's editor and had to do a regular column. Sometimes the subject that I found that I was going to use for a lead turned out to be so interesting that I did a feature, and then I had to look for another lead. I've always felt that the women's clubs did a lot of good in the community, and I was happy to give publicity to any of their efforts that really had a purpose. I remember being asked by the publisher of the Forum, Norman Black Jr., how come I use the Junior League in so many stories, because I told him they do interesting things. His wife happened to be a member, and I think he was getting a little kidding. But it wasn't because the membership included Mrs. Black or the wealthier women in the FM, but what they accomplished with that wealth. As I said, there weren't a lot of big news events, world-shaking or even community-shaking. But I think as a woman's editor, I did cover most of the angles of the women's activities. Of course, we ran into the feminist angle, and the name of the section was attacked. Why was there a special section for women if not for men? So I said, partly in jest, partly, that the sports pages and most of the rest of the newspaper took care of the men. The women had to have something. That didn't go over well, and we ended up with the name of Family Section. But after I retired, the name Lifestyle was adopted. Back in 1959, when I was sent to Columbia University for a seminar for women's editors, that was shortly before I took over the women's editor job, I saw the beginnings of the trend away from strictly women's news. There were already lifestyle sections cropping up. I never had any interest in being anything more than a woman's editor. I was not interested in chasing ambulances or covering murder or sex court cases. I covered one council meeting for Stan Cowan because he had to be somewhere else that night. And Roy Johnson, who is famed for his historical coverage, was writing for the Forum at that time. I scribbled and I wrote and I took it to Stan, and he looked it over, and then he took a copy of the morning Forum and checked everything, because Roy's stories were most of them were in there in the morning Forum. And so Stan really didn't have to depend on me for that thing. But that was the only coverage I did of the council. I remember one of the things was that Dr. Humphrey, who was mayor at that time, said when they were discussing the reflecting pool at the American Legion Hall that it was a real messy looking place, and it took a lot of care, and maybe they should fill it in with dirt and plant some flowers. And I thought, I gave a couple lines to that. Roy Johnson made a whole story of it. About, he went back in and said when this was built and what they'd had in it and all that sort of stuff. So I learned another lesson in being aware of features. There was a time when young women coming out of journalism classes would not even think of going into the women's section. But those we hired as summer interns said they were able to cover a much wider variety of stories in the women's section than if they'd been assigned to a particular beat on the city desk. And they learned to spell names correctly. My vindication came, I think, when young women did start applying for jobs, and not only young women, but young men. a young fellow who had been working on the night desk at the farm, applied to fill the vacancy we had in this section. That was about, I think, about 3 years before I retired. And I hired him. He said that he felt he had a far greater opportunity to try out his ideas, both in makeup and stories, than he did at the Straight News Desk. I've been rambling on here, but I there are some things that I kind of like to reminisce on before getting over here. I like the column I wrote on what great kids the boys who delivered the paper were. Of course, I included son David. He had a paper, and he earned good money, and he saved it and bought bicycle and so on. He later took up journalism, much against our better judgment, because newspaper work, it does not, you do not make much money in newspaper work, especially in this size community. He went to the UND, he went to University of Minnesota, and he went to Northwestern at Evanston for his journalism, and he worked on the Chicago Tribune, and then later he went to the Des Moines Register Tribune, and stayed there until about 5 years ago, I think it was, and then he got a job in the public relations department at McDonnell Douglas in Long Beach, and so he says that his training in the newspaper business is done him a lot of good in working in public relations, because he understands what the news media wants in the way of stories. Our other two sons, Barry and Breck, didn't go into journalism, although Breck did take the journalism course at MS from Howard Binford. And I remember the Christmas basket fund that the Moorhead Daily News and KFGK, I think it was, there's a radio station down in the basement of the old Comstock Hotel. And the Moorhead American Legion sponsored for at least 2 years in the early 30s. People sent in requests, as they do now, in telephones, and said they'd pay so much money for whatever entertainer would do something. And one of the most popular was for Manny Margette to sing the Norwegian song, Kan du glomme glomme Norge. Some of my best memories at the forum was a result of a column I wrote in, I think it was 1973, in which I listed several requests for help. One was from a Sarah Hughes in Ireland, who was asking people to take children into their homes for 6 weeks during the summer to get them away from that horrible atmosphere of fighting over there. And sometime after the item appeared in my column, the forum got a call from a Twin Valley couple who had answered Mrs. Hughes' appeal. And they were going to have Mrs. Hughes' son with them that summer. Well, nobody remembered that it was, the item, first item was in my column, so they assigned another reporter to the story. But I had many opportunities to meet the youngsters and meet Mrs. Hughes, because the program went on a long time and involved several hundred people before it finally closed. Mrs. Hughes told me that she had written the same letter of appeal to newspapers all over the country, and I was the only one that had used her appeal. Another column that gave me a lot of pleasure was in the interview, and the result was with a Mrs. Geller, who had lived just a block from Front Street in Fargo for years and years, and now Urban Renewal was going to shove her out. So I went down to interview her and her life, and I wrote a column and thoroughly enjoyed my experience with her. And she called me a few weeks later, and wanted me to come over, and she displayed a beautiful wood plaque on which my column was, what do they call it, plasticized or something, on it, and it was her, I think she called it godson and me, and Mr. Askenaz had it made for her, and see, he's well known in Fargo-Moorhead, especially at NDSU, for his gifts, including the main financial part for the NDSU theater building that it's named after him. I like to think that the woman section of the forum had something to do with the success of Bonanzaville, USA, the pioneer village at West Fargo. It was sponsored, it's operated by the Cass County Historical Society and has grown through the years to be a nationwide attraction. From the beginning, we had frequent stories on its progress, and the annual Pioneer Days held in the fall for several years. On those first years of the Pioneer Review, we worked out a special section featuring various activities at Bonanzaville. Wayne Peterson was my teacher, my mentor. And the last question in that is, how is it worded, Jen? The last question on that page, it's something about how you were influenced or how you remember people. And,
what memories do you cherish from those who taught you?
Mm-hmm. And I, Wayne is the one that I really cherish the memory of. He was tough, and he didn't pay much, but he had a successful paper. It was the first successful paper that had been in Moorhead for quite a few years, and actually, the Daily News never was a success after he left it, and even the forum with its money back of it after they bought it some years ago, they just couldn't make it go, and so they merged it with the forum, and so Wayne really had a talent. He sometimes expected the same thing of the people that worked with him, and a lot of us didn't have that much to give. I remember a young woman wrote or contacted me and wanted to know about the Daily News. She said her thesis was going to be on papers that had survived the Depression, and how did they do it? And the Daily News was one of them they had given for her to check on, and so she wanted to know what I thought was the most outstanding feature that kept it on. Not only kept it on, but it grew during the Depression. And I said, well, when you finally came down to it, it was Wayne Peterson. He just kept plugging and kept everybody else plugging. So there were those who have some harsh things to say about him, especially some of his former employees, because he demanded a lot and didn't pay much. But they did a darn good job when they were at the Daily News, and the forum recognized it, and he got they all went, a lot of them went on to the forum and other bigger papers. As his employee and his kid sister-in-law, I saw many facets of his personality, and I'm grateful for what he did for me. And I'm rather proud that I can feel I lived up to the tasks he set for me, even after he wasn't my boss anymore. One of my favorite columns is one I wrote after Helen and Wayne celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary in 1971, and I wanted to quote the toast he made to Helen. I called him and said, I want to use the quote, but I wasn't sure I had it down right. And reporter and editor to the last, he said, it went this way, I'm pretty sure. But he left the, and he quoted it, and then he left the phone and came back with the with his notes. And he was going to be doggone sure that it was right. Now, I've talked all this much. Is there anything else that there, do we have time or what?
Well, maybe just we could take a few more minutes and talk about some of the affiliations that you came in touch with in communications, and I think one of them in particular would be North Dakota Press Women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it. We weren't charter members of the North Dakota Press Women's Group. It originated as a kind of a group that the wives of the editors of the small town of the North Dakota weeklies mostly, they formed it so that they could have something to do while the husbands were in the business sessions and so on. And but later it got to be more of a much more of a professional group. And of course, there were some women in that group originally that either they were their husband's right hand or they operated the published the paper themselves. But a lot of them were wives who weren't involved in the actual operation of the paper. And then, as I say, it got more professional, and we got more on the national field. Then. Ruth and I joined, and I can't remember the year, but we joined simply because we were going to have the convention, the Newspaper Association convention in Fargo, and so we had arranged the women's activities. So we joined the press women at that time, and then we started sending in. Papers for to be judged for in the national or state and national contests and so on, and Ruth and I had when she was still editor, we had a second place in on the national, and while I was women's editor, we got a second place in the national. We never made it to. First, because we were competing in a pretty good size. The competition was pretty wide because it was 50,000 circulation and over, and so you can see that there'd be quite a few papers. So we were pretty happy with second place.
There was a good deal of camaraderie, though, and you. It seemed that maybe North Dakota Press Women might have bound together other women that were in the profession and brought you in mm-hmm. to a group that taught you something.
Yeah. It unfortunately at first the only meetings we had were the two, at first we had just one, and that was when the Press Association met, and then we started having a fall workshop. Then we started to say, well, now we don't really have to meet at the same time as the men do, because there were mostly, at that time then, women were coming in that had no connection with the papers, with the small town papers. They were coming in and working at the different, well, like the Daily Minot Daily News, where you were, and at the Forum and the Valley City paper and all those. And they were not wives of editors or anything like that. So we felt that it would be a good idea to separate and meet at different times, and we've been doing that for years, and it's grown into a good organization. But even then, it still was only two meetings a year. So then we started, I think Bismarck Group started that. It started a local group, and they met like once a week or every 2 weeks or something like that, and got together and discussed problems and so on. And so when we heard how what a good time they were having in Bismarck, we organized one in Fargo, and it's called the Media Club. And you don't have to be a member of the Press Women to belong to Media Club. And in fact, there are a lot of them that are just, you know, public relations and so on that come. And it's a good group, don't you think?
Oh, it's a wonderful group.
Mm-hmm. And it comes as close, I think, to, what do you call it, the old boys network or something like that?
The good old gals.
The gals get a chance to, if there's a job opening or anything like that, why it spreads around the media club or the press women, whichever comes first.
And you were in Press Women for over 25 years.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I got my 25-year certificate several years ago.
And you served as president of that organization?
Yeah, I served as president. I was regional director, and at that time, regional director took in, like, I think it was like three states, North Dakota, Minnesota, and Iowa. And there wasn't any Press Women's group in Minnesota. It had been pulled out. So I had that great big region of North Dakota and South Dakota. But we had fun. We'd go back and forth.